It's interesting to see that I was going to take a bit of a risk here today, because you've been gracious enough to invite me to talk to you a number of times over the years. It's a bit like that saying, though, that, you know, if I found an organisation willing to have me as a member, I wouldn't want to join it. But I was going to take a risk and say, well, what are some of the things that I've told you about over the years? But you can't remember what you were told last week about the second Advent candle, so perhaps I did overestimate the crowd just a smidgen. But here, take a punt. What are some of the things that I've talked about?
I remember more of the things I've done, actually.
Uh-huh.
It was blindfolding and leading each other at Easter camp.
Yeah, all right. And any related content to that?
I agreed to stand up all day.
Yeah, good, good. Come on. I'll just go home. There's no point in telling you anything. You're not going to remember it next week anyway. Uh-huh, yeah, good, good. Any bit of theology attached to it?
I can feel a common thread coming
on. About trust? Yeah, maybe. Oh, well. That really is a dilemma. Why bother, hey? Someone once said to me that if you really wanted to find a method that works less well than a sermon does, you could, but you'd really, really have to try. Anyway, look, I've told you the two things really already that are the most important, one theological, one missiological, in the past. One is about the pearl of great price, that in God's eyes you are a treasure that he will give his all to find. The author, whose name has now escaped me, there you go, who said, God is nice and he likes you, is a good summary, Adrian Plass, well done, a good summary of all the theology that you need to know. Well, I guess that God regards you as a pearl of great price, worth giving everything he has just to have you as his own, isn't a bad summary of theology either. And the other one was a summary of missiology. And that is a bit from Thessalonians, where Paul says that that what he did in Thessalonica was share not only the gospel with them, but their whole lives as well. And as a model for mission in the world, that's not bad either. So I've already told you the only two things that I think are really important. So I really don't know why I'm here at all.
Have morning tea.
Well, I reckon let's go straight to morning tea. But Lynn and I have been to Afghanistan for 3 months in the last year and are heading back. And a number of people here have been in touch with that journey a bit already. But I want to talk a little bit about what Afghanistan was like and what we're going back to. And then to give a brief sort of theological snapshot. And there's a few pictures and things in the middle of it too. So earlier this year, or late last year, Lynn and I were coerced to go to Kabul for 3 months to fill a teaching vacancy in the school run by the International Assistance Mission, IAM is its abbreviation, for its own expat, the kids of its expat staff in there, and for other like-minded agencies. So it's a primary age school really for kids of expats working in Afghanistan. A school had about 30 kids in it. Lynn's class, because Lynn ended up being the principal teacher there, was a year 2-3 class with about 11 kids in it. And she, Lynn's role was full-time teaching that class of year 2-3s. I did a bit of part-time teaching there. I taught science to them and social studies, a topic which I knew nothing about, to a year four to sixth class and did one period of PE for all the classes in the school one morning. And look, I don't wish to complain, but some of you may know that Perth has a 7-day winter weather cycle. Well, Kabul does as well. And it either snowed, hailed, sleeted or rained every Sunday for the 12 weeks of the school term. Now, why would I complain about that? Well, Sunday morning was PE. And there is no room in the school to do PE anywhere inside, so you do it outside in the snow, rain, hail or sleet. But there was one fine morning, one fine Sunday morning during school term. That was a morning that that I was off and someone was taking my class for me. Ken alluded to the fact that God has a sense of humour. Well, I suspect that was confirmation of it. Oh, and my PE, my science class, was exploring soil. Well, that's fine if you got through the 30 centimetres of snow to find anything that resembled soil. In addition to my role in the school, I spent a bit of time working with IAM, helping them develop a management school for their senior Afghan staff, and I did a bit of crisis management training for them as well. Now, our invitation to go to Kabul came from some good friends of ours, Phil and Julie Sparrow, who have been in and out of Afghanistan, mainly in Afghanistan, over the last 10 years. But Afghanistan is one of those places where every now and then you have to leave because something has occurred there. And we were fortunate enough that they were living on the top floor of a two-storey house, and Lynn and I had the bottom floor of that. Now, most houses in Afghanistan have multiple families living in them. That's just the way they do their housing. And they looked after us really well, as did the agency that we worked for. Kabul was and is, particularly in winter. Springtime is the time that kings go to war, according to the Bible. And spring is the time that the offensive starts in Afghanistan as well. So winter was pretty quiet in terms of security. So we didn't feel under any threat in terms of that. There were certainly far higher security precautions that you take there than you do walking around in downtown Perth. But if you take those precautions, then you're reasonably safe there. So we could walk around our neighbourhood, we could drive in safe taxis or IAM vehicles around in Kabul, we could fly to other cities in Afghanistan and drive around in those. But road transport in country Afghanistan is a no-no, as is just walking around the city by yourself. Westerners are high profile targets wherever you happen to be in that place. We did a bit of touring, and we'll show you some slides that will give you a bit better picture of life in Afghanistan than what me prattling on could probably do for you, so we'll do that. As we were leaving Afghanistan, we were asked whether we would go back for a longer stay. We had already been told a thing called SARS, which according to them is the Sudden Afghan Return Syndrome. That expats are wont to catch, that there are a number of things which strangely enough draw people back to Afghanistan as a country. In terms of the work that we were doing, there are three things in particular. One is that it does have a bit of a Wild West feel about it. I drive a courier ute here, and it's just interesting that every courier ute in Kabul belongs to one of the branches of the military / police and normally has a machine gun mounted on its roof. Mine doesn't have that here, nor the rocket launchers, nor the barricades outside the house and the blast walls and the security frisks whenever you go into a building. So there is a bit of that Wild West adventure to it, and there is something perversely attractive about that. So that is one of the things that draws people back. It is an exciting place to be. The second thing is that the expat team and the senior staff team of IAM are good people doing great work, and the expat team particularly are an elite group of people working there, and it's just good fun to be involved in elite groups of people doing things. It is very energising, well, at least it is for me, very energising, and so being involved in that sort of a group of people doing the sort of work that they're doing, I think is also attractive and draws people back. And of course, the last thing is that the expat community there is a very, very strong sense of community. We felt really well looked after. We got to know people there really well. There were relationships with significance and integrity built even for us over the 3 months that we were there. We could see it in the lives of other people there who had been connected within that community for far longer than that, that the sense of community that was there was something very, very significant, and makes most church expressions of community back here look like pale imitations of that. So certainly Afghanistan is a different place to be, and it has lots of things about it which, if you read the newspaper, you think that's a dodgy place to go. Well, it is. But it also has lots of things that are good about it and lots of things that draw people back to it. So at the end of the 3 months, we were asked to go back, and it's not a done deal yet. We're still negotiating with a partnership of two sending agencies, TIER Australia and InterServe Australia. And it's not a done deal, but unless there's some unforeseen things over the next month, then it looks like we'll be headed back around March, April of next year for a 3-year stint there. This time Lynn will be probably working part-time in the school and hopefully doing some work with adult Afghans teaching English as a foreign language. And my role will be within the agency as one of their support directors, someone who provides support and oversight to local Afghan project managers. IAM runs around 30 projects in Afghanistan. A number of those are in the adult education area, and that will be my area of responsibility there. I don't parlez-vous the français, and neither do I speak Dari, which is one of the two principal languages of Afghanistan. And so our first 6 months will be spent in learning Dari, important for me within my role because I'll be working with Afghan project managers, less important for Lynn if she just ends up teaching in primary school in terms of role, but still really important just being able to survive within the country where English is relatively limited. Now, at one level, Kabul and Perth are completely different. And for lots of people in Kabul, and in fact for lots of people throughout the world, when they look at the life that we have in Perth, they think that we in fact are living in heaven on earth. We whinge about stuff, you know, we complain about the colour of the paint on the hospital walls. But our first world problems are just that. They are first world problems. We live in just an incredible place in an incredible time in history that is in fact, from their perspective, heaven on earth. And I remember watching a documentary about the British forces in Afghanistan, and a person being interviewed made the comment that they knew that there was hell because it was Afghanistan. It is desperately poor, traumatised by decades, almost centuries of invasion and civil war. It is traumatised as a country. It is deeply divided internally. It doesn't function well as a political system. It may never function well as a political system, and is highly at risk of heading into steep decline. And the other night I was out enjoying a beautiful Perth evening and was struck by the thought as to why move from heaven to to hell. And I've talked about God's sense of humour, and I suspect I heard him chuckle once again as he talked about, talked about, the fact that that metaphorical journey for me is nothing compared to the real journey for him from heaven to earth to hell for our sake. So missiologically, again, here is the journey that Jesus has gone through for our sake, and which as his people he calls us to journey on as well. But scratch beneath the surface of Kabul, and the image of hell disappears to a large degree. The people of Afghanistan are just like us. There is a small percentage of them who attract international media attention, and a vast majority who are just like us. The line between good and evil doesn't run between Kabul and Perth. It doesn't even run between the Western Church and the Muslim mosque. It runs between, divides every human heart. And there is good and evil in every person in Afghanistan, as there is for every person in Perth. And the good news of peace with God through Jesus is just as needed by people in Afghanistan as it is by people in Perth. And the call on God's people to be ambassadors for his kingdom here on earth is the same whether we live here in Perth or whether we live in Kabul. At one level, it's a bit more spectacular for Lynn and I to be living in Kabul than it is in Lockridge, than it is for people living even in Mount Hawthorn. But it is no different. The call to do mission here is just as significant as the call to do mission there. It's interesting that the call to do mission there is to do mission in a context which is far closer biblically to the sort of places that certainly the early church writers were talking about, culturally and even in terms of many of the lifestyles. And I want to give you a bit of a glimpse of some of those, firstly through a series of slides. It picks up the heaven on earth because it starts with some slides of downtown Western Australia and then moves to some slides of Kabul. And then later on I'll show you a short movie about the place we're going to. You have to hum along if you want any sort of musical background to this. there was a building there that the citadel that was built by Alexander the Great and destroyed by Genghis Khan. It's not a bad sort of a history.
About 30 Christian agencies who are committed to the development of the Afghan people. I am involved in four areas: eye care, mental health care, education, and socioeconomic development.
Training is the long-term solution for the problem of this country. Three quarters of the ophthalmologists all over the country have been trained by IA Nur. We get these doctors and mid-level people from rural areas where people have no accessibility to the eye care services. We train them here and we send them back to provide eye care services there.
Up till 1995, there was no mental health work in this country. I started working with communities around Herat, and after a while it was realized that they needed to have a mental health clinic to be able to serve these people.
Well, a remote rural area in central Afghanistan. So we do building wells to provide clean drinking water, or capping springs and bringing then piping water into the village. And adult literacy courses in winter when people are not so busy.
So we work in a project that's engaged in adult education. We want people to think about how to think for themselves. Some participants leave our courses saying, this is the first time anybody's asked my opinion in a classroom, or anyone has wanted to know what I think.
We've worked with renewable energy, and we've, for instance, in a period of about 15 years, developed micro-hydro units that really work well. And there are now local workshops that make these units and install them.
Our deputy PC is working with handicapped people and training local physiotherapists and orthopedic technicians.
IA has development projects in several locations around Afghanistan. What I hope to see is that foreigners become redundant in Afghanistan in the same way that they are pretty much in India and Bangladesh, countries that have taken charge of things themselves.
We need people with skills and with professions to train the Afghan people. For me, to actually bring about real change in this country, they will need people who will commit to learn their culture, to learn their language, and to walk side by side with them through whatever is coming ahead of them.
Foreign women in Afghanistan are like the third sex. We do a lot of things that local women don't do, and we have rights and freedoms that local women don't have.
For us as a family, it's really been positive, because we are much more family-focused here than we are in our home country.
I really enjoy teaching the kids in IAE. One of the things I love about teaching in Afghanistan is the variety of nationalities that I interact with.
It's dangerous, but it's not too dangerous.
Yeah, it's not like there's a ball under every house.
Something interesting happens every day. So you won't get bored. It's really good.
One of the awesome things about working in this country is the amazing expat community here. The people you meet all over the world
I find it energizing to work with people that have come to Afghanistan because, you know, they want to help and see things get better.
I'm in a position that I can do something for my people. I hope that one day, as another country, we can stand on our own feet and running our country.
Afghanistan is a country like the other countries. People are living here, people are working.
I think there's a need to feel deeply within you that it's the right place for you. The sense of calling, a sense of direction. If that sense is there, I think you'll see amazing things here.
We've worked in Afghanistan since 1966. We've been here through all the wars. God willing, we'll be here for decades to come.
So I want to look briefly at a bit of Bible and then give you a chance to ask Lynn some questions. Uh, 2 Corinthians 4 says this: "Therefore, since through God's mercy we have this ministry, we do not lose heart. Rather, we have renounced secret and shameful ways. We do not use deception, nor do we distort the word of God. On the contrary, by setting forth the truth plainly, we commend ourselves to every person's conscience in the sight of God. And even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. The God of this age has blinded the minds of unbelievers so that they cannot see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. For we do not preach ourselves, but Christ Jesus as Lord, and ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For God who said, let the light shine out of darkness, made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. But we have this treasure in glass, in jars of clay, to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us." Just a few things about that passage. The first is that it is God's mercy that we minister. And it is in God's mercy that we do minister. God is both the source of what we offer to people, and that is a great mercy. But it is also just by the mercy of God that we, in fact, are enabled to minister. We're not doing God a favour here. I suspect he could probably do it a little better than what we do. In fact, in verse 7 it says it's through our weakness that ministry is demonstrated and effected. It is through our ministry that God's power is seen. It's through our weakness that God's power is seen. So there are two things out of that. One is that that's nice and reassuring because there's some stuff that we don't need to worry about anymore. We don't have to worry about looking good. We don't have to worry about being polished. In fact, as we show our weakness to people, God's power is revealed in that context. And the second one is that we need to be honest, because if in fact we hide our faults as we minister to people, then I think God's power is hidden along with our faults. That it is only when we are prepared to open ourselves and be honest about the struggles that we have that's God's power is revealed. The second thing is that the gospel, the power of the gospel, is just mind-blowing. Verse 4 says, the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. Now that's something that can be found nowhere else on earth. The gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. Nothing else holds a candle to that glory. In Philippians 2, Paul writes, do everything without complaining, that you may become blameless and pure, children without fault, in a crooked and depraved generation, in which you shine like stars in the universe as you hold out the word of life. So we have this treasure. We have this thing which is the glory of God, who is the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. That is the treasure that we hold as his people. And yet I'm constantly amazed about myself and about others, about how we view that. Yeah, I know and believe that this treasure is mind-blowing. Here's an analogy. So I found this way to get $10 million, and it's available to anyone. So I go and get my $10 million, and I keep it and I use it, and my life is greatly enhanced by it, and I get along quite nicely. And a few years later, a friend of mine who's been struggling financially stumbles across that same secret, goes and gets their $10 million, comes back and tells me about it. And my response is, oh yes, I've known about that for years. Well, there is a painfully long pause, and my friend then says, so why didn't you tell me about it? Oh, well, I didn't think you'd be interested. Now, to some degree, that's my attitude to this incredible treasure that I hold, the gospel of Christ. The glory, the image of God, is something that I hold. And yet I sometimes don't seem to work that out. So it's fortunate that Paul goes on to talk about that treasure being held in jars of clay. And it's not just that I forget the value of the treasure, bad as that is. But I sin, I get depressed, I get distracted. Even when I'm well-intentioned, I often get it wrong. I'm lazy, I'm indifferent. And you're probably all far worse than me. Because I do have some degree of humility. No, well, obviously not there either. But we have this treasure in jars of clay. And it's one of those funny things about God's kingdom, that we almost have to be like that for God's power to be shown. We have to be as bad as we are at doing ministry for God's power to be shown. Otherwise people would just get confused about, well, is this church thing just a group of people who have got their act together and I can join it and I'll get my act together? Well, no, this church isn't a group of people who have got their act together. Although we sometimes pretend that's not the case. We are a group of sinners saved by God, and we have this treasure in jars of clay. And it's with that mindset that Lynn and I go to Afghanistan. Not as people doing a really good thing, but just as people who will struggle to minister there as much as we struggle to minister here. So the last thing I want to say is that the little movie sort of has an implied invitation that they're looking for people to go to Afghanistan. And that's true. It is a country in great need. And you don't have to be anyone special to go there. You just have to believe that it's the place that God wants you to be. So think about it. Lynn would be happy to answer any further questions that you have. But, you know, there's, as I think it was to Greg that we said, you know, we could tell you some of the things about our about all of Afghanistan, or we could tell you all of the things about some of Afghanistan, but it would take us a while to tell you all of the things. So are there things that you say, oh, but what about X? Paul.
Why now?
Well, what? Well, why not? Well, why now? For us, there's some pragmatic things that made a lot more sense 12 months ago than what they do now. We have parents who are getting older. If we leave it much longer, then that becomes a significant problem for us. We have kids who are about to enter a breeding program. If we leave it much longer, then that just makes that a bit harder for us. And the other one is that, well, this is when we were asked. So part of it is that I guess we've tended to operate on that basis, that when we're asked to do something is the time for us to think about it pretty seriously. There are some... we've been asked to go for 3 years. Afghanistan is always the, well, who knows what's going to happen in the next 12 months, never mind 3 years, and the troop withdrawal is... does have the potential for things to go seriously pear-shaped. It does also have the potential for things, for some things to get sorted out that have to be sorted out and can only be when there are not foreign troops on Afghan soil. So. Yep. It's illegal for an Afghan to be anything other than Muslim. So for an Afghan to be Christian is a real problem. They either need to keep it hidden or they need to leave the country. A visible Afghan church would have a very, very short shelf life. For Westerners, the agency we go with is a Christian agency and is known and registered as such, and we are free to, at a government level, we are then free to gather and worship, and we do, and that sort of stuff. But certainly being seen to be trying to encourage Afghans to become Christians is just not on the agenda. There are like-minded Afghans in Afghanistan. So it is different and difficult. And if you do the wrong thing, then generally Westerners are expelled from the country, generally. At an official level, there certainly are Westerners who have been killed because they were Christians. IAM, the agency that we're going with, in fact, had 10 people in an eye care project killed in 2010. So.
Non-Christian NGOs
operating. Oh, yeah. 90% of...
I'm talking
Islamic.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the Aga Khan Foundation and Red Crescent and all of those. 90% of Afghans' gross national income is aid.
The bulk of it is either secular or Christian, but there certainly is a large amount of Muslim aid going there as well. Yep, last one.
Christian and Muslim aid organisations work together?
No.